The parade of the Toreadors began, and they came out with the sunlight glittering on the sequins and embroidery of their suits, as though they were the scales of some flamboyant reptile. The orchestra blared, and the keys to the bullpens were thrown down onto the sand. The Toreadors' capes were spread on the barrera below their favorites, and they retired from the ring. In the pause that followed, David glanced at the couple again. He was startled to find that they were both watching him, and the girl was discussing him. She was leaning on her companion's shoulder, her lips almost touching his ear as she spoke, and David felt his stomach clench under the impact of those honey golden eyes. For an instant they stared at each other, and then the girl jerked away guiltily and dropped her gaze. But her companion held David's eyes openly, smiling easily, and it was David who looked away. Below them in the ring, the bull came out at full charge, head high, and hooves skidding in the sand. He was beautiful and black and glossy, muscle in the neck and shoulder bunching as he swung his head from side to side, and the crowd roared as he spun and burst into a gallop, pursuing an elusive flutter of pink across the ring. They took him on a circuit, passing him smoothly from cape to cape, letting him show off his bulk and high-stepping style and the perfect sickle of his horns with their creamy points before they brought in the horse. The trumpets ushered in the horse, and they were a mockery, a brave greeting for the wretched nag, with scrawny neck and starting coat, one roomy old eye blinkered so that he could not see the fearsome creature he was going to meet. Clownish in his padding, seeming too frail to carry the big armored man on his back, they led him out and placed him in the path of the bull. And here any semblance of beauty ended. The bull went into him head down, sending the gawky animal reeling against the barrera, and the man leaned over the broad black back and ripped and tore into the hump with the lance, worrying the flesh, working in the steel with all his weight until the blood poured out in a slick tide, black as crude oil, and dripped from the bull's legs into the sand. Raging at the agony of the steel, the bull hooked and butted at the protective pads that covered the horse's flanks. They came up as readily as a theatre curtain, and the bull was into the scrawny roan body, hacking with the terrible horns, and the horse screamed as its belly split open and the purple and pink entrails spilled out and dangled into the sand. David was dry-mouthed with horror, as around him the crowd blood-roared, and the horse went down in a welter of equipment and its own guts. They drew the bull away and flogged the fallen horse, twisting its tail and prodding its testicles, forcing it to rise at last and stand quivering and forlorn, then beating it to make it move again. They led it from the ring, stumbling over its own entrails. Then they went to work on the bull, slowly, torturously, reducing it from a magnificent beast to a blundering hunk of sweating and bleeding flesh, splattered with the creamy froth blown from its agonized lungs. David wanted to scream at them to stop it, but sick to the stomach, frozen by guilt for his own part in this obscene ritual, he sat through it in silence until the bull stood in the center of the ring, the sand about him plowed and riven by his dreadful struggles. He stood with his head down, muzzle almost touching the sand, and the blood and froth dripped from his nostrils and gaping mouth. The hoarse sawing of his breathing carried to David even above the crazed roaring of the crowd. The bull's legs shuddered, and he passed a dribble of loose liquid yellow dung that fouled his back legs. It seemed to David that this was the final humiliation, and he found he was whispering aloud, "No, no, stop it, please stop it." Then the man in the glittering suit and ballet shoes came to end it, and the point of the sword struck bone, and the blade arced, then spun away in the sunlight, and the bull heaved and threw thick droplets of blood before he stood again. They picked up the sword from the sand and gave it to the man, and he sighted over the quiescent, dying beast, and again the thrust was deflected by bone, and David found that at last he had power in his voice, and he screamed, "Stop it, you filthy bastards!" 12 times the man in the center tried with the sword, and each time the sword flicked out of his hand, and then at last the bull fell of its own accord, weak from the slow loss of much blood, and with its heart broken by the torture and the striving. It tried to rise, lunging weakly, but the strength was not there, and they killed it where it lay, with a dagger in the back of the neck, and they dragged it out with a team of mules, its legs waggling ridiculously in the air, and its blood leaving a long brown smudge across the sand. Stunned with the monstrous cruelty of it, David turned slowly to look at the girl. Her companion was leaning over her solicitously, whispering to her, trying to comfort her. She was shaking her head slowly in a gesture of incomprehension, and her honey-colored eyes were blinded with weeping. Her lips were apart, quivering with grief, and her cheeks were awash, shiny with her tears. Her companion helped her to her feet and gently took her down the steps, leading her away blindly like a new widow from her husband's grave. Around him, the crowd was laughing and exhilarated, high on the blood and the pain, and David felt himself rejected, cut off from them. His heart went out to the weeping girl. She, of all of them, was the only one who seemed real to him. He had seen enough also, and he knew he would never get to Pamplona. He stood up and followed the girl out of the ring. He wanted to speak to her, to tell her that he shared her desolation, but when he reached the parking lot, they were already climbing into a battered old Citroen CV100, and although he broke into a run, the car pulled away, blowing blue smoke and clattering like a lawnmower, and turned into the traffic heading east. David watched it go with a sense of loss that effectively washed away the good feeling of the last few days. But he saw the old Citroen again 2 days later, when he had abandoned all idea of the Pamplona festival and headed south. The Citroen looked even sicker than before, under a layer of pale dust and with the canvas showing on a rear tire. The suspension seemed to have sagged on the one side, giving it a rakishly drunken aspect. It was parked at a filling station on the outskirts of Zaragoza, on the road to Barcelona, and David pulled off the road and parked beyond the gasoline pumps. An attendant in greasy overalls was filling the tank of the Citroen under the supervision of the muscular young man from the bullring. David looked quickly for the girl, but she was not in the car. Then he saw her. She was in a cantina across the street, haggling with the elderly woman behind the counter. Her back was turned towards him, but David recognized the mass of dark hair now piled on top of her head. He crossed the road quickly and went into the shop behind her. He was not certain what he was going to do, acting only on impulse. The girl wore a short floral dress which left her back and shoulders bare, and her feet were thrust into open sandals. But in concession to the ice in the air, she wore a shawl over her shoulders. Close to, her skin had a plastic smoothness and elasticity, as though it had been lightly oiled and polished, and down the back of her naked neck, the hair was fine and soft, growing in a whirl in the nape. David moved closer to her as she completed her purchase of dried figs and counted her change. He smelled her, a light summery perfume that seemed to come from her hair. He resisted the temptation to press his face into the dense pile of it. She turned, smiling, and saw him standing close behind her. She recognized him instantly. His was not a face a girl would readily forget. She was startled. The smile flickered out on her face, and she stood very still looking at him, her expression completely neutral, but her lips slightly parted and her eyes soft and glowing golden. This peculiar stillness of hers was a quality he would come to know so well in the time ahead. "I saw you in Madrid," he said, "at the Bulls." "Yes," she nodded, her voice neither welcoming nor forbidding. "You were crying." "So were you." Her voice was low and clear, her enunciation flawless, too perfect not to be foreign. "No," David denied it. "You were crying," she insisted softly. "You were crying inside." And he inclined his head in agreement. Suddenly she proffered the paper bag of figs. "Try one," she said, and smiled. It was a warm, friendly smile. He took one of the fruits and bit into the sweet flesh as she moved towards the door, somehow conveying an invitation for him to join her. He walked with her, and they looked across the street at the Citroen. The attendant had finished filling the tank, and the girl's companion was waiting for her, leaning against the bonnet of the weary old car. He was lighting a cigarette, but he looked up and saw them. He evidently recognized David also, and he straightened up quickly and flicked away the burning match. There was a soft whooshing sound and the heavy thump of concussion in the air as fire flashed low across the concrete from a puddle of spilled gasoline. In an instant, the flames had closed over the rear of the Citroen and were drumming hungrily at the coachwork. David left the girl and sprinted across the road. "Get it away from the pumps, you idiot!" he shouted, and the driver started out of frozen shock. It was happy 5th of November, a spectacular pyrotechnic display, but David got the handbrake off and the gearbox into neutral, and he and the driver pushed it into an open parking area alongside the filling station while a crowd materialized, seeming to appear out of the very earth, to scream hysterical encouragement and suggestions while keeping at a discreet distance. They even managed to rescue the baggage from the rear seat before the flames engulfed it entirely. And belatedly, the petrol attendant arrived with an enormous scarlet fire extinguisher. To the delighted applause of the crowd, he drenched the pathetic little vehicle in a great cloud of foam, and the excitement was over. The crowd drifted away, still laughing and chattering and congratulating the amateur firefighter on his virtuoso performance with the extinguisher, while the three of them regarded the scorched and blackened shell of the Citroen ruefully. "I suppose it was a kindness, really. The poor old thing was very tired," the girl said at last. "It was like shooting a horse with a broken leg." "Are you insured?" David asked. And the girl's companion laughed. "You're joking. Who would insure that? I only paid $100 for her." They assembled the small pile of rescued possessions, and the girl spoke quickly to her companion in foreign, slightly guttural language, which touched a deep chord in David's memory. He understood what she was saying, so it was no surprise when she looked at him. "We've got to meet somebody in Barcelona this evening. It's important." "Let's go," said David. They piled the luggage into the Mustang, and the girl's companion folded up his long legs and piled into the back seat. His name was Joseph, but David was advised by the girl to call him Joe. She was Deborah, and surnames didn't seem important at that stage. She sat in the seat beside David, with her knees pressed together primly and her hands in her lap. With one sweeping glance, she assessed the Mustang and its contents. David watched her check the expensive luggage, the Nikon camera and Zeiss binoculars in the glove compartment and the cashmere jacket thrown over the seat. Then she glanced sideways at him, seeming to notice for the first time the raw silk shirt with the slim gold Piaget under the cuff. "Blessed are the poor," she murmured. "But still, it must be pleasant to be rich." David enjoyed that. He wanted her to be impressed. He wanted her to make a few comparisons between himself and the big muscular buck in the back seat. "Let's go to Barcelona," he laughed. David drove quietly through the outskirts of the town, and Deborah looked over her shoulder at Joe. "Are you comfortable?" she asked in the guttural language she had used before. "If he's not, he can run behind," David told her in the same language, and she gawked at him a moment in surprise before she let out a small exclamation of pleasure. "Hey, you speak Hebrew." "Not very well," David admitted. "I've forgotten most of it." And he had a vivid picture of himself as a 10-year-old, wrestling unhappily with a strange and mysterious language, with back-to-front writing, an alphabet that was squiggly tadpoles and in which most sounds were made in the back of the throat, like gargling. "Are you Jewish?" she asked, turning in the seat to confront him. She was no longer smiling. The question was clearly of significance to her. David shook his head. "No," he laughed at the notion. "I'm a half-convinced non-practicing monotheist, raised and reared in the Protestant Christian tradition."
"Then why did you learn Hebrew?"
"My mother wanted it," David explained, and felt again the stab of an old guilt. "She was killed when I was still a kid. I just let it drop. It didn't seem important after she had gone."
"Your mother?" Deborah insisted, leaning towards him. "She was Jewish?"
"Yeah, sure," David agreed. "But my father was a Protestant. There were all sorts of hell when Dad married her. Everyone was against it. But they went ahead and did it anyway." Deborah turned in the seat to Joe.
Did you hear that? He's one of us. Oh, come on, David protested, still laughing. Mazel tov, said Joe. Come and see us in Jerusalem sometime. You're Israeli? David asked with new interest. Sabras both of us, said Deborah, with a note of pride and deep satisfaction. We're only on holiday here. It must be an interesting country, David hazarded. Like Joe just said, why don't you come and find out sometime, she suggested offhandedly. You have the right of return. Then she changed the subject. Is this the fastest this machine will go? We have to be in Barcelona by 7. There was a relaxed feeling between them now, as though some invisible barrier had been lowered, as though she had made some weighty judgment. They were out of the city, and ahead the open road wound down into the valley of the Ebro towards the sea. Kindly extinguish cigarettes and fasten your seatbelts, David said, and let the Mustang go. She sat very still beside him, with her hands folded in her lap, and she stared ahead when the bends leapt at them and the straights streamed in a soft blue blur beneath the body of the Mustang. There was a small, rapturous smile on her mouth, and the golden lights danced in her eyes, and David was moved to know that speed affected her the way it did him. He forgot everything else but the girl in the seat beside him, and the need to keep the mighty roaring machine on the ribbon of tarmac. Once, when they were twisting down into a dry, dusty valley, in a series of tight curves, and David snaked the Mustang down into it, with his hands darting from wheel to gear lever, and his feet dancing heel and toe on the foot pedals, she laughed aloud with the thrill of it. They bought cheese and bread and a bottle of white wine at a village cantina, and ate lunch sitting on the parapet of a stone bridge while the water swirled below them, milky with snowmelt from the mountains. David's thigh touched Deborah's as they sat side by side. He could feel the warmth and the resilience of her flesh through the stuff of their clothing, and she made no move to pull away. Her cheeks were flushed a little brighter than seemed natural, even in the chill little wind that nagged at them. David was puzzled by Joe's attitude. He seemed to be completely oblivious of David's bird dogging his girl, and he was deriving a childlike pleasure out of tossing pebbles at the trout in the waters below them. Suddenly, David wished he would put up a better resistance. It would make his conquest a lot more enjoyable, for conquest was what David had decided on. He leaned across Deborah for another chunk of the white, tangy cheese, and he let his arm brush lightly against the tantalizing double bulge of her bosom. Joe seemed not to notice. Come on, you big ape, David thought scornfully. Fight for it. Don't just sit there. He wanted to test himself against this buck. He was big and strong, and David could tell from the way he moved and held himself that he was well-coordinated and self-assured. His face was chunky and half-ugly, but he knew that some women liked them that way, and he was not fooled by Joe's slow and lazy grin. The eyes were quick and sharp. You want to drive, Joe? He asked suddenly, and the slow grin spread like a puddle of spilled oil on Joe's face. But the eyes glittered with anticipation. Don't mind if I do, said Joe. And David regretted the gesture as he found himself hunched in the narrow back seat. For the first 5 minutes, Joe drove sedately, touching the brakes to test for grab and pull, flicking through the gears to feel the travel and bite of the stick, taking a burst of power through a bend to establish stability and detect any tendency for the tail to break out. Don't be scared of her, David told him, and Joe grunted with a little frown of concentration creasing his broad forehead. Then he nodded to himself, and his hands settled firmly, taking a fresh grip, and Deborah whooped as he changed down to get the revs peaking. He slid the car through the first bend, and David's right foot stabbed instinctively at a non-existent brake pedal, and he felt his breathing jam in his throat. When Joe parked them in the lot outside the airport at Barcelona and switched off the engine, all of them were silent for a few seconds, and then David said softly, "Son of a gun." Then they were all laughing. David felt a tinge of regret that he was going to have to take the girl away from him, for he was beginning to like him, despite himself, beginning to enjoy the slow deliberation of his speech and movements that was so clearly a put-on, and finding pleasure in the big, slow smile that took so long to reach its full bloom. David had to harden his resolve. They were an hour early for the plane they were meeting, and they found a table in the restaurant overlooking the runways. David ordered an earthenware jug of sangria, and Deborah sat next to Joe and put her hand on his arm while she chatted, a gesture that tempered David's newfound liking for him. A private flight landed as the waiter brought the sangria, and Joe looked up. One of the new executive Gulfstreams. They tell me she's a little beauty. And he went on to list the aircraft's specifications in technical language that Deborah seemed to follow intelligently. You know anything about aircraft? David challenged him. Some, admitted Joe, but Deborah took the question. Joe is in the Air Force, she said proudly, and David stared at them. So is Debs, Joe laughed, and David switched his attention to her. She's a lieutenant in signals. Only the reserve, Deborah demurred. But Joe is a flyer, a fighter pilot. A flyer? David repeated stupidly. He should have known, from Joe's clear and steady gaze that was the peculiar mark of the fighter pilot. He should have known by the way he handled the Mustang. If he was an Israeli flyer, then he would have flown a formidable number of operations. Hell, every time they took off, they were operational. He felt a vast tide of respect rising within him. What squadron are you on? Phantoms? Phantoms? Joe curled his lip. That isn't flying, that's operating a computer. No, we really fly. You ever heard of a Mirage? David blinked and then nodded. Yeah, said David. I've heard of them. Well, I fly a Mirage. David began to laugh, shaking his head. What's wrong? Joe demanded, his smile fading. What's funny about that? I do too, said David. I fly a Mirage. It was no use trying to get hot against this buck, he decided. I've got over 1,000 hours on Mirages. And it was Joe's turn to stare. Then suddenly they were both talking at once, Deborah's head turning quickly from one to the other. David ordered another jug of sangria, but Joe would not let him pay. He repeated for the 50th time, well, that beats all, and punched David's shoulder. How about that, Debs? Halfway through the second jug, David interrupted the talk, which had been exclusively on aviation. Who are we meeting, anyway? We've driven across half of Spain, and I don't even know who the guy is. The guy is a girl, Joe laughed, and Deborah filled in. Hannah, and she grinned at Joe, his fiancée. She's a nursing sister at Hadassah Hospital, and she could only get away for a week. Your fiancée? David whispered. They're getting married in June, Deborah turned to Joe. It's taken him 2 years to make up his mind. Joe chuckled with embarrassment, and Deborah squeezed his arm. Your fiancée? Asked David again. Why do you keep saying that? Deborah demanded. David pointed at Joe and then at Deborah. What? He started. I mean, who? What the hell? Deborah realized suddenly and gasped. She covered her mouth with both hands, her eyes sparkling. You mean you thought... Oh, no, she giggled. She pointed at Joe and then at herself. Is that what you thought? David nodded. He's my brother, Deborah hooted. Joe is my brother, you idiot. Joseph Israel Mordecai and Deborah Ruth Mordecai, brother and sister.